I'd like you to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. If I speak in the languages of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all that I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away, and as for tongues, they will cease, and as for knowledge, it will pass away. For our knowledge is imperfect, and our prophecy is imperfect. But when the perfect comes, the imperfect will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see through a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall understand fully, even as I have been fully understood. So faith, hope, love abide. These three. But the greatest of these is love. Will you join me in prayer? Some time ago, our family had the opportunity during a single summer to travel across the United States and up into Canada, and then to visit seven countries in Europe. As you might imagine, during that time, we talked with a large number of Christians, and we were a bit dismayed to discover that there were many Christians, evangelical Christians, who were a bit upset about their local churches. For many Christians, church was something to endure rather than something to enjoy. As we were returning home, my wife asked me one of those questions, which was really more of a comment. How many people do we know, she said, who find their involvement in a local church a meaningful and contributive experience? If I was trying to think of an answer to her question, I thought of that small boy who went to his pastor and asked him about a plaque that was hanging in the lobby. The pastor said that that plaque contained the names of the people from that congregation who had died in the service. And the youngster replied, which one? Sunday morning or Sunday evening? And we came away with the feeling that there were many Christians who might not object to the suggestion that instead of awarding attendance pins, we might award distinguished service crosses, or maybe even Purple Hearts. But I'd like to face that question this morning. What's wrong with the church? And I'd like to ask it not as a cynic sitting in the grandstand, but as somebody who is very much a part of the game. What's wrong with the church? Or to put the question in a more positive fashion, what is the church's greatest need? I suspect that we could go around this congregation this morning and many of you could give us many helpful suggestions. Some of you might suggest that the deepest need of the church is for communicators, for men and women who can stand above an age that has lost its direction and speak a sure word from God. Still others might suggest that the deepest need of the church is for teachers, for people who understand the scriptures and understand the society and know how to bring the two together. Still others might say that the deepest need of the church is for people who have had exciting spiritual experiences and move out into the society to share that experience with others. I think all of those suggestions would have a great deal of merit. Certainly, we do need people who can communicate. People who can stand before a society that has lost its direction and speak to that society in terms that they will understand. And in a day when rose-colored fog often takes the place of Christian doctrine, we do need teachers. People who understand the scriptures and know how to apply them to life. And in those churches that have a theology that's as clear as ice and twice as cold, we do need a band of God-intoxicated men and women who have sensed the touch of God upon their lives and move out to share that touch with others. And yet, speaking frankly, I know of at least one church that had all of these. In that congregation, there were people that could rightly be called prophets. When they stood to speak, people in the congregation, people in the community, sensed that they were hearing an authentic word from God. In that church, there were teachers. People who understood the scriptures and knew how to apply them to life. What is more, there were people who had had marvelous spiritual experiences. People in that congregation had had the authentic gift of tongues. They could speak in languages that they had never studied. And yet when Paul wrote to that congregation in Corinth in what is now Greece, he recognized that in spite of their many faceted gifts, the church just wasn't doing very well. On paper, it should have been leading the league. In performance, it was struggling to stay out of last place. It was a church that Paul said came behind no other in spiritual gifts. Whatever they needed in terms of teaching and administration, in terms of faith or tongues, that church had. It was a church that seemed to have everything. And Paul was no man to downgrade spiritual talent. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul tells those Corinthians that they needed to use their spiritual abilities to build one another up. But then at the end of that chapter, Paul pauses for a moment and says, if you're really going to build a strong and vital and vibrant church, you ought not pursue the path of gifts. Instead, I give you another path to choose. And that was the path of love. If you happened to miss it there, you would have found it in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 1, where Paul begins that chapter by saying, and above everything else, make love your aim. And then between chapter 12 and chapter 14, we have 1 Corinthians 13. One literary critic has said of this great song to love that it is the noblest, finest, deepest thing that the Apostle Paul has ever written. And what Paul is trying to say in this great song to love is what Helen Hayes, the actress, once said about charm. He's saying that love is that thing which, if a church has it, makes everything else vital and alive. And if a church doesn't have it, anything else the church has really doesn't matter. If you look at the hymn closely, you will discover that it's divided into three stanzas. And in stanza one, which is verses 1 through 3, what Paul is saying is that apart from love, all of our spiritual gifts, all of our service, and all of our sacrifice amounts to nothing. If I speak with the languages of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. It's clear that in this chapter, Paul is contrasting love with spiritual gifts. And the gift that the Corinthians prized most highly was the gift of tongues. It was showy and spectacular and perhaps set them apart as being a kind of super saint. And so Paul begins with that gift and imagines a man who has it. Here's a man who could speak all of the languages of earth. And in addition, can speak the language of angels as well. Obviously, no one has ever had that talent. I knew one man who was able to read 34 languages and speak in half of them. But as far as I know, he never held a conversation with an angel. But imagine what a magnificent missionary a man like this would be. One of the staggering problems that we have had in getting the gospel to the different corners of the earth has been the problem of language. Men and women have had to give their entire lives in order to learn a language to be able to begin to preach the gospel to some distant tribe. But this man wouldn't have had that problem. Just as soon as he landed at the airport, he could speak to anyone that he met. As soon as he strolled into a village, he could speak the language in any dialect that was needed. What is more, because Paul says that he can speak the language of angels, I gather that this man is not only a brilliant linguist, he is also an accomplished orator. He not only speaks precisely, but he speaks with emotion and beauty. So that as he speaks, people are stirred by what he says. And yet Paul says that if a man has that gift so that he can speak all of the languages of earth and the languages of heaven, if he does not have love, he is a sounding brass and a clanging cymbal. The word that is translated sounding brass or noisy gong is the Greek word chalkos. It was a gong that was hung in the garden of pagan temples. And whenever the priest wanted to summon people to worship, he would slap that gong and the din would be heard throughout the community. The tinkling cymbal of the King James Version is a rather poor translation. It is really a clanging cymbal. It was a symbol used in pagan worship, very much like the symbols used in a symphony orchestra today. And one thing that that gong and that symbol had in common, and that is that there was no music in them. By themselves, all that they produced was a senseless din. Imagine that next Christmas, you decide to give some unfortunate friends of yours who have small children a gift. You give to those children a gong and a pair of symphony cymbals. I imagine that they might get through Christmas Day because this Christmas spirit will cover almost anything. But what would happen would be the next morning. The orgy of December 26th. The children march in, playing with their new toys, and enter their parents' bedroom, and one of them slams the gong, and the other one crashes the cymbal. And the parents wake up vibrating from the tips of their toes to the roots of their hair. You give children a gift like that, you're going to put a strain on the nervous system of the parents. And a severe strain on your friendship. Because all those instruments can do is to make a loud noise. Loud and distracting. There's no music in them. And Paul is saying that even if you can speak the languages of all men on earth and talk with angels, if you do not have love, then all you do is make a senseless din. I remember some time ago, a woman, part of the congregation of a large northeastern church, they had a pastor who was a gifted expositor, a man noted as being a brilliant orator. Unfortunately, when the man was out of the pulpit, he was often cold and indifferent and sometimes harsh. She said in a conversation almost wistfully, You know, when he's in the pulpit and we listen to him preach, we sometimes wish he would never leave it. But when he's out of the pulpit and we see the harsh and rigid way he lives, we often wish he'd never get in the pulpit again. For you see, whenever a teacher teaches, whenever a preacher preaches, whenever a Christian witnesses, we not only speak about the truth, we say other things by the way we speak. We tell people what we feel about the truth. But we also tell people what we think about them, and even more important, what we think about people, about other Christians who disagree with us. And there is a way in which you can use truth like a club in such a loveless manner that the lack of love destroys the truth that you are trying to preach. And perhaps it was for that reason that Jonathan Edwards, one of America's noted theologians, said, "I have made it the aim of my life never to compose a sermon, never to write a book, unless I am convinced that I am motivated by love for those to whom I speak or write." Paul is saying that apart from love, our gifts accomplish nothing. But then Paul takes the argument one step further. And he says that apart from love, even the greatest gifts make us nothing. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If the Corinthians valued the gift of tongues, then Paul valued the gift of prophecy. That was for him a gift that could contribute to the church of Jesus Christ. And so he imagines a man who has prophetic powers. What is more, he understands all mysteries and all knowledge. Imagine what a teacher he would be. Here is a man who never had any clouds in his intellectual sky. Here was a man who never had a theological problem that he could not unravel. Here's a man who never came to a passage of Scripture that he did not understand. He understood it all. And what is more, not only is he a man who understands the truth, but we've already seen he's a man who can communicate it. He is able to speak in the tongues of men and of angels. I've known some scholars seem to have had knowledge stored in their minds like the gold at Fort Knox. But when it came to getting it across to other people, they couldn't make change for a 10-cent piece. But this man was able to do it all. What is more, he has the gift of faith so as to remove mountains. Imagine that this is the kind of man who founds a church, the kind of man who establishes a seminary, kind of man who begins missionary organizations. He can see the obstacles that all the rest of us can see, those mountains that seem to stand in the way of fulfilling the task. But as a man of faith, those mountains seem to become valleys and the path becomes smooth. The kind of man we would admire. The kind of chap about whom we would write biographies, the kind of super saint that stands out in Christian history. And yet Paul says that if you have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge and have all faith so that you can move mountains with your faith, if you do not have love, you yourself are nothing. Let's imagine that tonight, during the worship service, that you put a $20 bill into the offering plate. Let's imagine that the treasurer of the church takes that $20 bill and uses it to pay my honorarium. Then imagine that I take that $20 bill and use it to buy groceries. And the grocer takes the $20 bill and uses it to pay his rent. And the landlord takes the $20 bill and uses it to buy a suit of clothes. And then the clothier takes that $20 bill along with other bills and takes it to the bank. When he gets to the bank, the teller is counting out the money, and he comes to that $20 bill. And he discovers that it's counterfeit. Now that bill has gone all over Dallas doing a number of good things. It's contributed to the offering. It has paid me an honorarium. It has bought food. It has purchased clothes. It has paid the rent. But when it gets to the place where real values count, it is discovered to be counterfeit. It's very possible for people who have spiritual gifts to be exercising those gifts in such a way that they make a great impression upon other people and, in a sense, do a great deal of good. But when they stand before God, with whom only real values count, they themselves can be discovered to be counterfeit. So Paul says, that apart from love, our gifts of eloquence accomplish nothing. And our other gifts make us nothing. He carries the argument one step further, and in verse 3 he says, if I give away all that I have, and if I deliver my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Now Paul has moved from gifts the service of the sacrifice. He imagines a man who makes some very interesting sacrifices. For example, the sacrifice of property. If I give away all that I have, this man isn't just a tither or a double tither. He gives away everything. Not only the interest, but the principal as well. You see, you can't love without giving. But it is perfectly possible to give without loving. And even though your gift may be a lavish display, if it is given apart from love, you gain nothing. In fact, Paul says, if I give my body to be burned and have not love, I gain nothing. We're not quite sure what picture Paul has painted on the wall of his mind when he says, if I give my body to be burned. It's possible that he may be thinking of a man who races into a house, a burning building, in order to rescue a friend from danger. It's possible that he is thinking of those three Hebrew sons, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who went into a fiery furnace rather than to deny their faith in God. It's possible that he was thinking of something that took place in the first century, where Christians who valued the ministry of other Christians who happened to be slaves would sell themselves into slavery so that another man might go free and thus be freer to minister. And when that occurred, this man who sold himself into slavery had the mark of the branding iron burned into his skin. I say, we do not know what picture Paul has painted on the wall of his mind, but the point is obvious. That if I give my body into slavery or even into martyrdom, if I do it without love, I gain nothing at the judgment seat of Christ. All of your gifts, all of our service, all of your sacrifices amount to nothing apart from love. When you come into church here at Believer's Chapel, you're given a program. I'm not always sure why programs are distributed, unless it's like the football game, that you can't enjoy it unless you know the names of the players. But I also suspect that there might be other uses to which you could put that program. For example, in the next couple of Sundays, if the sermons are particularly dull, this might save you from ultimate distraction. programs have been used for doodling. Let me suggest that if you would like to doodle, that you can turn it into a positive spiritual experience. If the sermon is dull, you might start making a group of zeros on that program. And after you get a line of zeros, that line of zeros adds up to nothing. And so you might start in with the next line of zeros, and after you've got two or three or four, you still have nothing. Dull sermons also happen to be long, and so you'll probably have some more time, so you can fill the front page and turn it over and then take the next page and fill it with zeros. When that whole program is filled with zeros, the whole program, in terms of zeros at least, adds up to nothing. But if you take one zero and in front of that zero put a one, you get a 10. In front of two zeros, you get 100. In front of three zeros, you get 1,000. In front of six zeros, you get 1,000,000. And in a way, that's what Paul is saying about love. You can take your gifts, your sacrifices, your service, and line them out. And if they are done in a loveless spirit, they add up to nothing with other people or with God. But take even the least of the gifts. Even the smallest sacrifice, even the tiniest bit of service, and do it in love, and love gives to that gift significance. And it adds up to something in the lives of other people and before God with whom we have to do. Apart from love, all that we do is worthless. We need to listen to that. Because in our seminaries, in our seminary, in our churches, in our church, there is a way in which we can put a great emphasis on the ability to understand the truth and to communicate it. We put a great emphasis on service and sacrifice and on dedication. But there can be a kind of Christian service from which all love is squeezed. A kind of Christian service which is little more than the neurotic compulsion of duty. There can be a lovelessness about the things we do that instead of helping each other actually build barriers instead of bridges. Apart from love, it is possible that our service and our ministry can have absolutely no fruit at all. Paul is saying that without love, our eloquence accomplishes nothing. That we ourselves are nothing. And that when we stand before the judgment seat of Christ, we will gain nothing. That raises a question, doesn't it? The question is one that the crooner asked some time ago when he sang, "What is this thing called love?" I'm not surprised that he would ask. Listening to popular music, I'm sure he did not find the answer. That old black magic with icicles running up and down your spine. It's when the moon hits your eye like a big piece of pie. It's love, love, love. The lyrics mark me, but they haven't really changed that much. What is love? You don't quite know how to handle it in a society like ours. You walk down the street and there is a billboard that says, "Love in the Raw, rated X." Or somebody says, "I just love strawberries, but they give me a rash." Somebody says, "Well, the score is 15 love. I think I'm going to take the set." There's this thing called love. It's used so widely. It was used in New York by a young man who killed his girlfriend. And when he was asked why he did it, he said, "I just loved her so much I couldn't let her live." It was used by the followers of Charles Manson to justify their murders. It's been used by Elizabeth Taylor to talk about the lusts of her life. What is this thing called love? You discover that in verses 4 through 7, Paul tells us. He gives us in this second stanza not a definition of love, but a description of love. You see, there are some things you just can't define. You really cannot define a sunset. It doesn't do much good to say that music is the science of the art of tones. I'd much rather hear one prelude than to have a definition like that. It doesn't do much good to say that a diamond is native carbon, an isometric crystal. Just show me one diamond ring and I know more about diamonds than that definition will tell me. And so, in these verses, Paul does not define love. He describes love. And he says that love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful. It is not arrogant or rude. Love does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things and believes all things and hopes all things and endures all things. And when you look at that list of things that love does, it seems to me that there are at least two factors that need to be kept in mind. One is that this kind of love of which Paul speaks is not primarily a thing of the emotion. When Paul talks about love, he's not talking about feelings. Dr. John White, a Canadian psychiatrist, has spent some time studying the emotions that often go with the word that we use as love. He points out that there is a kind of love that we have over which we have no control. It's the love that a mother has when her firstborn baby is brought to her. It's wrapped in pink or blue, and the mother takes that babe into her arms, and something happens to it. Like Dr. White says, there is actually a biochemical change. It's as though her whole body reached out to embrace that baby. I've never had a baby myself, but I have noticed of those who have that you don't bring the baby in the afternoon and say, now, dear, we want you to hug the baby, but this evening we have a night nurse, and she is just excellent at teaching mothers how to love babies. She will exhort you, and pretty soon you will find that you really are reaching out, and there's going to be a love for that infant. No, you don't exhort it. You don't pray for it. It's just there. Sort of what you get when you fall in love. It's infatuation. It hasn't got a lot to do with real love, but it's a lot of fun. We call it puppy love and laugh at it, but it's very real to the puppy. It's the kind of thing that you feel you can't control. It's almost a biochemical change. That's not what Paul is speaking about. The love of which Paul speaks here is not a matter of the feelings. It is primarily an act of the will. It is an act in which I determine, because of the grace of God at work in me, to seek the other's highest good, to put the other person's interests before my own. Paul, when writing to the Thessalonians, said, you have no need that anyone teach you to love. The Spirit of God himself has taught you that. The one mark of being a true believer in Jesus Christ is that this is the kind of person you want to be. And you can be that kind of person because you are indwelt by the Spirit, who is love itself. But it's an act of the will in which you seek the other person's highest good, which you put the other person's interests before your own. Let me show it to you in just two instances. Paul says in verse 4 that love is not boastful. I find that strange. I would have thought that the opposite of boasting would have been humility. Paul says that the opposite of boasting is love. There's a way in which we can turn boasting into a fine art. Say things just the right way so that we can make ourselves look good. When we do that, Paul says that we are not being loving people. What's he mean? Well, often when we say that somebody is proud of being intelligent or good-looking or rich, we think that's what we're saying, but that's not true at all. We're not proud of being good-looking. We're proud of being better-looking than someone else, proud of being richer than other people, proud of being more talented than people around us. So the person who boasts is using other people as a platform for his or her virtues. Other people exist to build us up, and the comparisons that we make are usually at their expense so that we will come off, subtly or directly, looking good. And when I do that, I am not loving the other person at all. I do not exist for them, they exist for me. And that's a lack of love. That's selfishness. Well, look at another one. He says in verse 5, love is not irritable. Now, doesn't that strike you as a bit of pious nonsense? I mean, I don't understand why Paul says that love isn't irritable. Because I get irritable. I think I'm a pretty loving person. My irritability has nothing to do with love. It's because I live a busy schedule. I mean, I've got sermons to prepare, and I've got lessons to get, and I've got classes to teach. And man, if you knew my schedule, you would understand why I'm irritable. And when my son and daughter come into my study in the midst of something important being done for the kingdom of Christ, and they interrupt me with some stupid nonsense, of course I'm irritable. It has nothing to do with love. If you only knew how important I was and how much the church depends upon me, you would understand that these interruptions are going to bother me. It's not irritability, that's righteous indignation. Until you stop and think about it. Then you realize that when people do that, you're not looking at them as people at all. You're looking at them as interruptions. My son and daughter and my wife and scores of other people have a claim upon me. When I suddenly realize that they are people with needs and that I have the ability to meet that need, when I stop thinking that the universe ought to revolve around me, and around my schedule, and around my ministry, and around my activity, and realize that I have been made in Jesus Christ a man for others. And I see these people as people who have legitimate needs that I can meet. I can adopt an attitude that purifies me. And the resentment can subside. And I can respond to meet their highest good. That's an act of the will. That's a decision that you make that you will benefit other people and that they do not exist for you. You exist for them. I have wrestled with this over the years. Some folks have the disposition of a cocker spaniel. It seems to me when they were born, they are warm and friendly. I think I was born with the disposition of a bulldog. Over the years, I have wrestled with this ethic of the New Testament. And I have found something that's been of help to me. I found that as I come before God in a time of devotion, that I can use this passage from 1 Corinthians to be of help to me. You'll find as you read the commentators that they have a couple of things they want to tell you. One is that the translation charity of the King James Version really should be translated love. And another is to tell you that this is really a description of Jesus Christ. But you could say that Jesus Christ is patient and kind. That Jesus Christ was not jealous or boastful. He was not arrogant or rude. He did not insist on his own way, and he was not irritable or resentful. I find that helpful. But for me, at least, I find that a kind of pious cop-out. Because in this chapter, Paul is not primarily telling me about Jesus Christ. He's telling me about me. And I have found that by putting my name into this passage, something happens to me in the ministry of the Holy Spirit. I'd like to do that. Rather than have you sit there in judgment upon me as I do it, put your name in the passage. You're saying that Haddon Robinson is very patient and kind. Haddon Robinson is not jealous or boastful, is not arrogant or rude. Haddon Robinson does not insist on his own way and is not irritable or resentful. He doesn't rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. He bears all things and believes all things and hopes all things and endures all things. There have been times when I have put down that passage, when I really had to fall upon my knees and confess to God that I am not only an unbelieving person, I'm an unloving person. But isn't this the kind of person you want to be? I mean, isn't this what God's doing in your life? If you have come to know God personally, isn't there something in the depths of your being as you read that where you say, yes, that's the kind of person I want to be. In our church, in our home, I want to be characterized by that kind of virtue. My answer is you can be. In the power of the Holy Spirit, you can adopt an attitude that will purify you. In the last stanza, Paul's point is that love never ends. In opposition to the gifts, they'll all be done away. There's a time when prophecy will no longer be needed. There came a time when the gift of tongues no longer served its purpose. The time when knowledge fades away and we shall see things as they really are. Love is greater than the gifts because the gifts will pass away and love will abide. At the end of the passage, he says that love is the greatest of the virtues. So faith, hope, and love abide. These three. But the greatest of these is love. He's saying, I take it, that there will never be a time when we will not be people of faith. Throughout eternity, that is how we will have a relationship with God. There will always be hope. For the Christian, the best is always yet to come. Our tomorrows will always be brighter than our today. There will be faith and hope and love. But the greatest of these is love. Greatest because the name and nature of God is love. It's by love that we have a relationship with God. And the relationship throughout eternity with those who are God's people. What's the greatest need of the church? What's the greatest need of believers' chapel? From what Paul says, from what we sense in the depths of our being, the answer is love. People who have spiritual gifts and serve, not for what they can gain, but for what they can give in love. Let's pray about it. Father, that's what we want to be.
As a husband, that's what I want to be to my wife and to my children. As a teacher, that's what I want to be to my students. As a minister of the word, that's what I want to be to a congregation. And we know that that's true for each of us who has really come to know God personally through faith in Jesus Christ. We confess our sinfulness. Confess our hard-heartedness. But we thank you that the fruit of the Spirit is love. That is the basic ethic, the basic motive of the Christian faith. So we ask that for this church, that while we are known in the community as a church that teaches Christian doctrine in clarity and purity, and we thank you for that, grant that we shall be known in this community as people who love one another. We ask you that the people across the street may feel that about us. The folks who deal with us in trivial ways may feel that.